Dr. Green received his Bachelor of Divinity from Wartburg College in 1946. He completed his Doctor of Theology at Friedrich and Alexander University in Erlangen, Germany, in 1955. With his dissertation directed by Werner Ehlert, Wilhelm Maurer, and Paul Althaus. Besides pastorates in Texas, South Dakota, Minnesota, Illinois, and New York, Dr. Green has served on the faculty of Frederick College in Portsmouth, Virginia, Appalachian State University in Boone, North Carolina, and Concordia Teachers College in River Forest. From 1980 to 1983, he served as professor of systematic theology at St. Catharines in Ontario. He has also served as assistant to the president of the Eastern District from 1988 to 1989. During his many years in parish and classroom, Dr. Green has authored 5 books and over 50 scholarly articles while participating in countless lecture series. His scholarship and churchmanship also include his love and accomplishment in music, both choral conducting and organ. Edwin Limon, Paul Bungis, Martha Zahetner, Robert Scoggin, and Jan Bender are just a few of those under whom Dr. Green was privileged to study. I have known him as one who is an accomplished parish musician and one who delights in leading God's people in worship. Presently, Dr. Green is continuing researching confessional Lutheranism during the Third Reich. He has also been especially involved in studying the works of Ehlert, Althaus, and Sasse, wedged in between his translations of some Lutheran chorales and the passion music of church cantatas of Bach and others. It is a privilege for me to see Dr. Green again, and together with you, to welcome him to our campus this morning as he presents his paper to us entitled Lutherans Struggling Against Hitler. Would you join me in welcoming Dr. Lowell Green?
Thank you. I feel kind of tired after hearing that beautiful introduction. Maybe I'm doing too many things. Is that going to stay there? Mm-hmm. Maybe a piece. I have a lot of unfamiliar terms. The handout sheet has some of them, and others I... Oh, good, a piece of tape. That's perfect. Others I put on the overhead, and I thought I could point to them as we moved along. I had the privilege of doing a doctoral program at Erlangen during the 1950s. This was the golden age of theology, with great theologians abounding in German universities. Erlangen had the renowned systematicians Werner Ehlert and Paul Althaus. Other eminent scholars who were my teachers there included Walter Künneth, Wilhelm Maurer, Walter von Leuwenhoek, Friedrich Baumgartel, Ethelbert Stauffer, Hermann Stratmann, George Kempf, and Fritz Fichtner. I did not get to know Hermann Sasse, since he had already gone to Australia when I arrived at Erlangen in the autumn of 1952. Until I began the present project in recent German history, I had published a number of books and articles in Reformation studies, particularly on Luther, Melanchthon, and the Lutheran Confessions, systematic theology, liturgics, and church music. I was awakened from my dogmatic slumbers about 10 years ago by the increasingly sharp attacks which were being leveled against several Erlangen professors who were now dead, and the realization that these were really attacks against confessional Lutheranism itself. This got me involved in writing the church history of the Third Reich. The unjust denunciations of good men and the putting down of confessional Lutheran churches called for speaking up in behalf of those who could not speak for themselves. I also was interested in the project because I had known or seen many of the major participants in the Kirchenkampf at various times before, during, and after my stay at Erlangen. Besides the Erlangen professors, I had heard or talked with such men as Bishop Meiser, Friedrich Gogarten, Karl Barth, Hans Asmussen, Martin Niemöller, Rudolf Bultmann, and Immanuel Hirsch, to name a few. Some of these men I only heard in open lectures or met on public occasions. With others, I had had extensive discussions about Lutherans struggling against Hitler. Besides these men in Germany, I had enjoyed close personal relationships with several German-Americans who knew the events of the Third Reich from experience. Paul Leo, Jan Bender, and Theodor Baudler, all of whom experienced Nazi oppression, and Julius Bodensieck, whose brother Hans Bodensieck was pastor of St. Mary Lutheran Church in Osnabrück, where he had played an important role in the resistance movement and had been interrogated by the Gestapo on more than one occasion. A number of books had been written which were one-sided and cast a dark shadow over the Lutheran Church. Men from the Union churches wrote books which made themselves look good and made the Lutherans look bad. They insinuated that the Lutherans had cooperated too much with the Nazis. But an objective review of the historical record actually shows something rather different. As a matter of fact, all the Union churches fell to Nazism, and the only churches which remained intact were those with a strong confessional commitment, the three big Lutheran land churches of Bavaria, Württemberg, and Hanover. Moreover, during the Third Reich, it was not the big three Lutheran land churches, but the German Evangelical Church that was largely staffed by people from the Union churches, which almost totally capitulated to Hitler. It was distortions such as these that got me going and led me to seek for a suitable publisher. In the fall of 1998, I signed a contract with Berghahn Books to write a book entitled Confessional Lutherans During the Third Reich, with special attention to the theological faculty at Erlangen. My greatest temptation in writing this book has been to include too many personal anecdotes and stories. However, my colleague, Professor William S. Allen at the State University at Buffalo, and my publisher, Dr. Marion Berghahn, regard these firsthand experiences as an important aid in writing such a history. And therefore, there will be several chapters in my book which will include my experiences with some of these people, as well as scattered references here and there. The old cliche, from Luther to Hitler, is dead. The secular historians know this. But some Lutherans still fear that their church bears responsibility for the rise of Hitler and the persecution of the Jews. I cannot take time to discuss these matters today. Instead, I want to refer you to the book by Uwe Simonetto, The Fabricated Luther, published by Concordia in 1995. This author has thoroughly refuted the rumors that Lutherans favored Nazism or that Luther was an anti-Semite and a racist. If I have any criticisms of Simonetto, is that I would go further than he regarding Luther's essay Against the Jews and Their Lies, 1943, a work by Luther which has been unfairly criticized. But this would take a whole hour in itself and must be deferred to some other time. So we proceed at once into a discussion of the background of the churches during the Third Reich. Part 1, and I trust you have the outline in front of you. the historical background of the Kirchenkampf, or church struggle. Part A, developments prior to 1933. The old Prussian Union had been a forced merger of the Lutheran and Reformed churches in Prussian territory. The German state of Brandenburg had become almost entirely Lutheran in the Reformation. But in 1613, the Elector of Brandenburg had converted to Calvinism. For the next 200 years, there were many tense moments between the Reformed electors and their Lutheran subjects. In 1817, the Elector Frederick Wilhelm III, now called King in Prussia, was in power. The Prussian king was married to a Lutheran princess. Since Lutherans practiced closed communion, the royal couple could not receive the sacrament together as man and wife. Well, an absolute monarch could do something about that. He decreed the Prussian Union, in which 7,000 Lutheran churches were forced to merge with 131 Reformed congregations, to reform a union church in which the confessions were minimized for the sake of external harmony. The formation of the Prussian Union brought forth strong opposition from many Lutheran pastors and laymen, but their resistance was met by violent persecution. The confessional Lutherans who refused to accept the Prussian Union called themselves the Old Lutherans. Those who remained in Germany formed the Lutheran Free Churches, particularly in Silesia. And those who stayed in Germany faced much bitter persecution. Thousands of old Lutherans left Prussia as refugees, bound for North America or Australia. In America, the immigrants formed the Buffalo Synod, while others joined the Missouri Synod around Buffalo and Milwaukee, or became members of other Lutheran church bodies. During the Third Reich, it was a real problem for the Lutheran churches. They were not comfortable working with the Union churches because of their doctrinal ambivalence. One hears again and again from Lutheran leaders the concern lest the German evangelical church become a new Union church and swallow up the Lutherans. And it was an ongoing concern that one must not sacrifice one's loyalty to the Lutheran confessions for the sake of external appearance. B. Developments after the Nazi seizure of power. In 1932, a group of churchmen who were devoted to National Socialism started the German Christian Movement to help get Hitler elected. In May 1933, Walter Künneth, I think his name is both up here and also on your sheets, Walter Künneth, later a professor at Erlangen, but at that time working in Berlin, took the lead in establishing what was called the Young Reformation Movement, the Jung Reformatorische Bewegung. The objectives of this group were to counteract the sinister teachings and actions of the German Christians and to restore the teachings of the Reformation for their day. The following September, one of their number, Martin Niemöller, established the Pastors' Emergency League, or Pfarrer Notbund. This new organization was a more political operation, which gradually superseded the Young Reformation movement. However, Künneth's group continued to exist and to publish the periodical The Young Church, Junge Kirche. The Pastors' Emergency League soon enrolled thousands of Protestant pastors as it spread throughout Germany. From this group came the founding of the Confessing Church movement. The Confessing Church, or Bekennende Kirche, must be carefully distinguished from the Confessional Church, or Bekenntniskirche. The former group came largely from the Union churches and were often indifferent to the Lutheran confessions. In their name, the word confessing was an active participle, which meant professing one's faith in public actions. But the confessional church insisted upon loyalty to the Book of Concord. Followers of the confessing church movement sometimes regarded themselves as the true Christians and inferred that those who follow the Lutheran confessions and did not join with them were false Christians. In the years which followed, Künneth, as the founder of the Young Reformation, led a more moderate course within the Confessing Church, while Niemöller led the increasingly radical Dahlem Circle. Part C, we're going to jump ahead 20 years before we go back to the Hitler years, the Confessing Church after World War II. The Confessing Church didn't quit after the fall of Hitler, but continued by battling against the confessional Lutherans. On January 22, 1946, Martin Niemöller spoke at the University of Erlangen. His appearance had originally been scheduled for a smaller hall at the university, but the crowd was so large that the event was moved to the noted Newtown Church called the Neustädter Kirche, which could seat 1,300 people. Niemöller spoke before a group of students, many of whom had been drafted by Hitler, had been wounded in battle, had been placed in prison camps, and had finally gotten home and were sitting before him, living in cold, unheated rooms, hungry and ill-clad. Niemöller told them that they were all war criminals because they had fought in the war. He didn't mention the fact that he had asked Hitler that he could get out of the concentration camp and go fight in the war, and Hitler had said no. Niemöller's speech was coldly received. A number of students walked out, and there was strong disagreement with his position during the question and answer period which followed. Niemöller was embarrassed and humiliated at his cool reception, and he circulated to the newspapers the misleading rumor that he had been rejected because professors and students at Erlangen were Nazi sympathizers. After this, there was a growing tendency to accuse the Lutherans of having been soft on Hitler, of having refused to work closely enough with the Confessing Church during the difficult times of the Third Reich, and of fracturing the body of Christ by refusing to have joint communion services with those who were not Lutheran. The post-war remnants of the Confessing Church, led by Martin Niemöller, took a course of political activism in the 1950s and thereafter, in which they crusaded against German rearmament and the atom bomb, assailed the wars in Korea and Vietnam, advocated pacifism, and expressed their support for closer ties with communism and the Eastern Bloc countries. Both Karl Barth and Martin Niemöller went to Moscow after World War II to accept decorations from the communist government while they decried the American position in the Cold War. In a remarkable paper given at the Evangelical Academy at Tutzing in 1969, Wilhelm Maurer describes this strange revival of the Confessing Church. He tells how the Confessing Church Party regrouped after the fall of Hitler in 1945, even though there was no longer a National Socialist state to combat. They had learned from the Nazis how to employ propaganda and personal denunciations to achieve their ends, and they began a life and death struggle against confessional Lutherans, which incidentally they seem to have won. The effects of the post-war Confessing Church were very harmful to the Lutheran Church of Bavaria. Hermann Dietzfelbinger was a Bavarian pastor who had fought manfully against the German Christians and against the evils of Nazi totalitarianism. After the retirement of Bishop Meiser, he became the Lutheran Land Bishop of Bavaria in 1955. During the 1960s, he experienced many problems in that time of political radicalism, theological liberalism, and the cry for giving up the age-old positions of the Lutheran Church. Within the Bavarian Land Church, strong voices were calling for the changes advocated by the people from the Confessing Church, and the land bishop saw himself losing support. He realized that he could no longer hold out against the demands for the ordination of women and the cry for open communion, which was demanded by the Leuenberg Concord. Dietzfelbinger resigned his office and retired on May 1, 1975. His successor, Johannes Hanselmann, saw things differently and helped to introduce the ordination of women and open communion into the Bavarian Church. Similar events transpired in other Lutheran churches. The confessional Lutheran character of these churches was seriously injured, and the final outcome of that struggle was the imposition of the principles of the old Prussian Union upon the Lutheran churches of Germany that had escaped its tentacles in the 19th century and during the Hitler years in the Reich Church. Another aspect in which the Confessing Church misled the Christian community after the war was in fostering theological liberalism. Rudolf Bultmann, professor of New Testament at the University of Marburg, had been an exponent of Hitler and an advocate of the Confessing Church movement during the Third Reich. After the war, many people who were involved in the Confessing Church supported Bultmann's program of demythologizing the scripture. I have a whole paragraph on that I'm going to leave out. I think you're familiar with it. Although much of what Bultmann wrote has subsequently been forgotten, it seems as though an end result has been a loss of confidence in the Bible and the notion that one may reinterpret the scriptures within the context of the ideologies and social changes of today. For example, many think that Paul's teaching about women within the orders of creation are no longer binding upon us today, but may be reinterpreted in the light of the women's liberation movement. Part D, the response of the confessional Lutherans. Confessional Lutherans battled against both the political activism and the theological liberalism which were fostered by the Confessing Church after World War II. Kunnett called his controversy with the liberal theology the Second Kirchenkampf and said that this church struggle was more difficult than the Kirchenkampf during the Third Reich. And regarding those church leaders who got involved in politics, such as those who led a protest movement against rearmament or the atom bomb, or advocated more friendly relations with the communists, confessional Lutherans insisted that the church must not attempt to regulate temporal matters. When the church, which is the kingdom on the right hand, interfered with the state, which is God's kingdom on the left hand, the result is theocratic enthusiasm. Theocracy is no stranger to us in America. Our country, due to its Puritan heritage, has strong elements of theocracy in our consciousness. Our wars are holy wars. Our churches are national shrines which display the American flag, and our hymnals offer many patriotic songs which blur the distinction between the two kingdoms. But in discussing later actions of the Confessing Church, we've gotten ahead of our story, and let us now return to the situation in the 1930s. Part two, the theological faculty at Erlangen during the Third Reich. Our American students are not always familiar with the totally different structure of the European university. It might be helpful if I discuss briefly the academic traditions of Erlangen University, which go back to those of the University of Paris, which began in the 12th century. When I attended Erlangen, there were five divisions or faculties, as they were called in Germany. They ranked in the following descending order: theology, the queen of sciences, followed by law, medicine, philosophy, which is the same as liberal arts, and natural science, an outgrowth of liberal arts. Theology, law, and medicine are all postgraduate faculties. The doctorate in theology is the highest ranking degree in a German university, followed by law and medicine, all of which are postgraduate degrees. In Europe, a doctorate in philosophy, like the doctorate in natural science, is not a postgraduate degree, but only a graduate degree, and really a modern designation for the old Master of Arts. I think we all know there is nothing democratic about the rule of an American university today. I know. I taught in a state university for 12 years, and the faculty were never consulted about important measures. But the University of Erlangen followed the venerable tradition of self-rule by the professors. This meant that there was no president chosen from the outside, but that the professors themselves governed the university. The only full-time permanent officer was the syndicus, who was restricted to carrying on the business matters of the university. But academic matters were placed under the rector magnificus, or grand rector. The rector was a professor who held a two-year term, which alternated among the five faculties. For example, in the first biennium, Ehlert, as a member of the theological faculty, might be elected as the grand rector. He might then be followed by Hans Lehrmann, one of the most famous professors of the law faculty. The following biennium, the university would be headed by a member of the medical faculty, and so forth. Within the theological faculty, the position of decan or dean was alternated among the departments of systematic theology, church history, New Testament, Old Testament, and practical theology. But during the unrest of the Nazi period, Ehlert was made Decanus Perpetuus in 1935. So he stayed in office, leading his faculty, until he was ousted by the Nazis in 1943. This proved to be a wise choice. Ehlert always refused to join the Nazi party. But although he openly opposed the German Christians, he pretended to be favorable toward National Socialism. It appears that this attitude had been genuine at first. Apparently, Ehlert had welcomed the advent of Hitler in 1933 and approved of the new government up until the famous Röhm Purge of 1934. After this violence, Ehlert, as well as Althaus, became increasingly disenchanted with Nazism. Hermann Zasse, in his memorandum of 1945, declared that Ehlert pretended to support Nazism, a matter which embarrassed other theologians, but that he was not a Nazi from within or without, for his whole being militated against their teachings. And the fact is that Erlangen had the only theological faculty in any German university which remained intact, that is, avoided a Nazi takeover. Some important clarifications of Ehlert's conduct as dean of the faculty are found in his Report on the Deanship of the Theological Faculty of Erlangen, 1935 to 1943, a report which had been suppressed for over 40 years for unknown reasons and was first published by Karlmann Beischlag in 1993. Ehlert reports that Rector Specht came to his home to inform him that he had been named theological dean. Specht asked him how he stood toward the National Socialist state. Quote, "I replied that faithful to my oath of office, I would be ready for loyal cooperation, but that I could recognize the totalitarian demand of the state only so far as it was commensurate with the answerability of the Christian before God. At his question how that should be understood, I responded that that could first be made more precise in case of a conflict." After a brief silence, Specht said that he hoped that there would be no conflict in this respect. He later asked about my stand to the German Christians. When I sharply dismissed them, the conversation came to an abrupt end. A few days later, my nomination was approved. End of quote. A later rector, Molitaris, named a Nazi, Wilhelm Fohlrott, as an assistant professor of theology. Fohlrott was not a full professor, but he could attend faculty meetings. After this, Ehlert avoided calling official meetings of the theological faculty wherever possible and replaced them with coffee hours in his home so that the theological professors could discuss problems of the church without the presence of Fohlrott or Molitoris. In his report, Ehlert related that as dean, he had supported 40 to 50 students who were under suspicion by the Gestapo, either because they were of Jewish descent or because they had been involved in the church struggle at other universities and had come to Erlangen for refuge. These assertions were confirmed during the denazification proceedings after the war by the depositions of several Jewish pastors who testified that Ehlert had undertaken great personal risks to shield them from the Nazi party. One of these men even told how Ehlert had secretly diverted scholarship funds in his behalf, which were not supposed to be given to Jews. We cannot devote more time to this brief account of Ehlert's tenure as theological dean. Ehlert, along with two other deans, was deposed by Grand Rector Hermann Vince, a professor of medicine, for disapproving the nomination of an unqualified man to a position in the philosophical faculty, a nomination which had been demanded by men from the Nazi party. Part 3, the theological debate with Barth and the Barman Declaration. Barth rejected any revelation of God in the law and taught that the only revelation was in Jesus Christ, so that Althaus dubbed his theology a Christomonism. Like many other Reformed theologians, Karl Barth came from the theology of Neoplatonic dualism, which teaches that matter is evil and spirit is good, as expressed in the maxim, finitum non capax infiniti, that is, the finite cannot contain the infinite. This is why many Reformed theologians teach that the body and blood of Christ cannot be given in bread and wine. With his negative view of material things, Barth could not develop a real theology of creation. He opposed the concept of a natural knowledge of God from created things, from the pages of history, and from one's moral conscience. And, of course, he had no understanding for a theology of the orders of creation. He adamantly opposed the Lutheran distinction of law and gospel, which presupposed that there was a revelation of God in the law, which came prior to the incarnation and the gospel. He reversed their order into gospel and law, and he called the law only the needful form of the gospel. As Ehlert trenchantly observed, this abolishing of the law was actually antinomianism, and Barth's position accommodated the Nazis in a very dangerous way. Hand in hand with his rejection of law and gospel came Barth's repudiation of the doctrine of the two kingdoms. His lack of understanding for this doctrine showed his theocratic leanings, and in opting for a single kingdom view, Barth unwittingly cut the ground from under the separation of church and state, which was precisely the greatest problem of the German Protestant churches in seeking to avoid being merged with the Nazi state. Lutherans saw that these dangers in the theology of Barth had permeated the Barman Declaration so that it provided no real weapon against the German Christians. In the loss of the law and of the doctrine of creation, Barth and Barman had weakened the Christian argument against racism, persecution of the Jews and Gypsies, eugenics, racial cleansing and genocide, abortion, euthanasia, the destruction of the feeble-minded and mentally deranged, and the suppression of the Christian churches. Another area of conflict between Barth and the Lutherans was the doctrine of the ministry in the church. Barth called the church an existential event, Ereignis. He thought of confession as a fluid action rather than professing a written creed. And this understanding of confession separated the church from its historical roots. In the tradition of Calvinism, Barth advocated a congregational polity of church government. The church at large was to be operated according to democratic principles in a synodical form of church administration. Conversely, he condemned the centralized Lutheran churches headed by a land bishop, a man who was invested with strong powers of leadership. As we know in Lutheranism, the type of church structure or church polity is not a fundamental doctrine, but only an adiaphron, and therefore no one is required to approve any one structure of church politics. In Lutheran church law, only the means of grace, that is, preaching and the sacraments, are of divine authority, de jure divino, and all else, including church structure and polity, is by only human authority, de jure humano. But for the Reformed, church structure and polity are de jure divino, or by divine right, because they believe that the Bible ordains a specific form of church government and commands the following four offices: the ministry, the teaching office, elders, and deacons. Nevertheless, the Reformed do not follow the Lutheran doctrine of the means of grace. For them, the Word of God is not preaching, or put it the other way, preaching is not the Word of God, but the Word is a sacred book, the Holy Bible. Accordingly, preaching is not de jure divino, but a human form of discourse, and only the Bible has divine authority. In any case, events were quickly to show the weakness of the ecclesiology of Karl Barth. Although Hitler had no love for democracy or parliamentary procedure, certainly not for Barth, he thought that he could get control of the church through popular elections, and he advocated that all church leaders be chosen by the vote of the people. Hitler was right. In the church elections of 1932 to 1934, the German Christians, aided by the Gestapo, brought out the people, and those churches which operated by parliamentary methods were soon taken over by the German Christians and the Nazis. And in the Lutheran land churches, which had strong men as bishops, the German Christians and Nazis were unable to penetrate. An interesting example of how the effectiveness of a strong bishop worked is the case of August Meyerinds. The Church of Hanover, which was called an intact church, had a distinctive history. Through general elections in 1934, the German Christians got control of the Senate and the Upper Church Council. But Bishop Meyerinds was not a quitter. He rallied hundreds of faithful pastors and lay leaders in his huge territory to support his case. And he was able to set aside the Land Church Senate and the Upper Church Council, and strong leader that he was, to stymie Nazi infiltration into the Land Church of Hanover. When he was ousted by the German Christians, he took his case to the Supreme Court, which decided in his favor, and Meyerinds continued to be the stalwart leader of Hanover. Bishop Meiser of Bavaria and Bishop Wurm of Württemberg were also powerful leaders, but they had sturdier lay members than Meyerinds, so that when Meiser and Wurm were under arrest, mass demonstrations were organized in their support. Chartered railway trains came from Nuremberg and Ansbach and other places, bringing thousands of Lutherans to Munich to support their Bishop Meiser and carry out mass demonstrations. These demonstrations alarmed the Nazis, secured the release of both bishops, and allowed them to lead the flocks committed to their care. Had these big three churches not been led by strong bishops, it is doubtful that they would have withstood the Nazi incursions, and had they fallen, it is questionable whether the brethren councils in the destroyed churches would have survived Hitler at all. A word about the theology of orders. Building upon the doctrine of the first article, which teaches that we can learn about God from nature and from history, Lutheran theologians since Adolf Harless, 1806 to 1879, developed a concept of the orders of creation. These virtually coincided with the earlier doctrine of the three orders outlined by Luther in his Great Confession of 1528. The first order, the pastor office, the second, marriage and the family, and the third, temporal authority. Bonhoeffer added one's vocational career to the orders of creation. The German Christians added three more, race, blood, and soil. Gogarten endorsed these additions, and Althaus criticized them severely. Ehlert, in a published essay under the quizzical title of Bekenntnis, Blut und Boden, denied that the Barmen Declaration had the confessions on its side, that's the confession, and regarding blood and soil, he disallowed that the German Christians had a franchise on the blood and soil of the German folk. Instead, Ehlert insisted that blood or inheritance points to the doctrine of original sin and that the soil points to the earth as God's creation. The orders of creation have received little attention in American Lutheranism. In fact, some Lutheran writers have discountenanced them. But Johann Michael Roy gives a sound discussion of the orders in his book, Christian Ethics, published at Columbus, 1935, pages 256 to 395. That's the best discussion I've found in English. And during the doctrinal disputes in Missouri Synod during the late 1960s and early 1970s, the doctrine of the orders of creation was used by one writer to disavow the ordination of women, while another writer used that doctrine to establish it. We American Lutherans sometimes have reduced the theology of creation to the fight against evolution, and nobody listens to us because they think we're fundamentalists. Here we could learn a lesson from Lutherans in the Third Reich. Hitler was a student of Charles Darwin, Herbert Spencer, and Houston Stuart Chamberlain. If you want to see Darwinism at its best and its worst, turn to Hitler's doctrine of the Superman and the Aryan race and his concepts of eugenics, abortion, racial cleansing, and euthanasia to achieve racial superiority. Social Darwinism and the Hitler years are the real soft belly of Darwinism as a worldview, and we ought to attack them there. And we need to work toward a sound theology of creation, which recognizes that the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. There were at least two Bible verses with which Karl Barth could never fully cope. The first, Psalms 19, verse 1, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork." And a second one, Romans 2, 14 to 15, "When the Gentiles, who have not the law, do by nature the things contained in the law, they show the work of the law written in their hearts." To deal fully with the Barman Declaration would take us afield, and I'm not going to say much more about it except read my book when it comes out. But it is safe to say that Barman incorporated the theology of Barth with his errors in law and gospel, his rejection of the two kingdoms, and his hostility toward the natural knowledge of God. The Barman Declaration was rejected by many Lutheran theologians. These include Althaus, Ehlert, Zasse, Friedrich Ulmer, and Christian Stoll, who wrote an important pamphlet against it. Ehlert addressed Barth's view of law and gospel in an essay which was translated into English by Edward Schrader in the title, Law and Gospel. Ehlert wrote another criticism of Barth which has not been translated into English. I'm referring to his programmatic essay, The Church and Its History of Dogma, Die Kirche und ihre Dogmengeschichte, an article which was greatly admired by Jaroslav Pelikan and which he used as the program for his multi-volume work, The Christian Tradition, A History of the Development of Doctrine. Ehlert pilloried the discontinual or punctiliar view of the church and its history, which was held by Barth and by existentialism, dialectical theology, and the Barman Declaration. Ehlert held that the church was led astray by this constant harping upon the church as an existential event or erigenus, and its loss of the continuum of history. The mere action of confessing something, yes, of confessing anything, replaced fidelity to the confessions as statements of pure doctrine. These were consequences of a theological system which did not heed the lessons of history. Although Ehlert did not go into this matter, he could have strengthened his case by pointing out that the whole concept of crisis theology and the constant call for the moment of decision, Theodor Strom calls this decisionism, came from the same roots as Hitler's program of political romanticism. And crisis theology, Nazism, and philosophical existentialism were all nourished from the same roots of romanticism in which the individual was increasingly summoned to make some important decision. In the case of Nazism, the call for a decision was contradictory because Nazism didn't really allow folks to choose their own course, but insisted on accepting the decisions of Hitler and the Nazi Party. Conclusion. Did the Lutheran confessions make a difference? You bet they did. First, before the rise of Hitler, the confessions had been taken for granted, but they were a part of the church law to which both state and church were bound. In a number of crucial cases, the Lutherans cited their confessions and found that even the Nazi government was swayed by an appeal to the authority of the Book of Concord. Second, the confessions gave the Lutherans a definite doctrinal platform and a stiff backbone. This was lacking in the Union churches, which loosely accepted both the Lutheran and Reformed positions. As we have seen, every Union church fell to Nazism, and the three Lutheran land churches of Bavaria, Württemberg, and Hanover were the only churches in Germany to remain intact. Furthermore, the theological faculty of Erlangen, which was regarded as the one that was most loyal to the Lutheran confessions, was the only theological faculty in Germany that remained intact under the fall of Hitler in 1945. Largely thanks to Ehlert. The pity is that a group of professors with little sympathy for Lutheranism and with confessing church sympathies somehow infiltrated Erlangen after the war, and that in 1971 the faculty voted to abolish its traditional subscription of the Lutheran confessions. But now we must bring this to a close. Friedrich Baumgärtel was an Erlangen professor for Old Testament who insisted that the distinction of law and gospel must be paramount in Old Testament interpretation rather than the hermeneutics which were common in his day. Known for his steadfast opposition to National Socialism, he once told me this story. Several years early, an American journalist had been sitting in the same chair in his office in which I was sitting. The reporter had asked him, "How could you have been an officer in the German army at Hamburg and have done nothing to stop the goings-on in the concentration camp there?" Baumgartner responded, "Sir, as one coming from a free society, you have no concept of what it is like to live in a totalitarian state where all information is controlled by an evil government and where everybody lives in fear of being arrested." He told the newspaper man, "I did not know that there was a concentration camp near Hamburg, but if I had found out about it, I can assure you that I wouldn't have told a single soul." It is almost impossible for us to imagine the fear imposed by a terrorist police state where one is in constant danger of being visited in the middle of the night by the Gestapo. But when I read of Lutherans during the Third Reich with their brave and their not so brave responses, I sometimes wonder, would we have done better? Do Lutherans in America today stand up for their convictions? Or is there a readiness to be carried around by the shifting winds of doctrine and church practice? We can learn from Lutherans in the Third Reich how to confess Christ in America today. The Word of Scripture admonishes us, "Be ready always to give an answer to everyone that asketh you a reason of the hope that is in you," 1 Peter 3:15. From the confessing church, we can learn the importance of a bold confession of our faith. And from the confessional church, we can learn the need for our confession to be doctrinally sound. I think these two parts express the purpose of Concordia Seminary and of our dear Missouri Synod. May God make us faithful stewards of His mysteries.
Some questions that you might have for Dr. Green at either of the two microphones near the front.
Dr. Green, thank you very, very much. You made a comment toward the end that somehow Erlangen was infiltrated after the war. I would put to you that that was because, in part, of your own teacher. I quote from Sasse, who writes in a letter that when Stauffler was to be brought on the faculty, Sasse said to Ehlert, he said, "How can we let him on the faculty? He's not even Lutheran." And Ehlert's simple reply was, "Well, surely by coming to a Lutheran faculty, he will become Lutheran." Do you recall any discussion about that?
Who was the person that was being discussed?
Stauffer, the New
Testament. Stauffer?
Yeah, the New Testament man. He was a Moravian, I think, or a Mennonite.
Yeah, that's curious.
Yeah.
I know that Ehlert fought against Helmut Thielicke. And Thielicke, of course, has no good words for Ehlert in his book, what is it, something of a wayfarer. I think that Ehlert is sometimes disappointing in some of these decisions. I think he just thought that people would do the right thing. I studied under Stauffer, and he thought he was a good Lutheran. Do you think that Stauffer had anything to do with bringing the confessing church people into Erlangen?
My own opinion is that he did, but I don't know how much evidence.
Stauffer, you know, went down in disgrace. He was he got into a kind of a discipleship of Christ type of theology in his later years, imitation of Jesus, and it came to a confrontation between him and Paul Outhaus. And then he got into some moral interpretude, and he was forced to resign. Just how much influence he had on selecting of professors, I wouldn't know. But, that's a question. Outhaus could be very unconcerned about confessional matters. Outhaus stayed until, 1968?
By way of prefacing, there seems to be a little spurt of interest recently in some fields at looking at how people today have dealt with the past in their particular disciplines. There is, for example, a new book by a woman named Ernestine Schlant, who happens to be Bill Bradley's wife, It's a political candidate's wife who writes her own books, and they're worth reading, about the language of silence. She teaches German Lit at Montclair State, and she's gone through and to see how present-day German Lit people have looked at Holocaust and how people in the past have dealt with it and how well they've come to grips with it. To shift the focus a little bit, when you get to something like Reformation history, the question is to ask you to muse a little bit on how well people today, especially the Germans, are dealing with their past and with their teachers. Not everyone is always pleased. You know, there's a woman named Lautenschläger wrote a book about Joseph Lortz and basically called him a Nazi, and the people at Mainz were not real thrilled with that. And when suggestions are made, for example, for the Luther Congress, that we have a section that deals with the German Reformation historians from that period, that's held off with a 10-foot pole, and no one seems to want to talk about this. And I wondered, from your perspective, how well you think people are, or what people are doing, not how well, but what are people doing in terms of coming to grips with their past and their willingness to talk about this kind of thing?
I don't know how well qualified I am to respond to that. I think that Germans simply want to forget the past. And, of course, I suppose I have a somewhat revisionist view of the Holocaust. I think that Germans today have a right to forget the past. They're a new generation. And we do believe, we say in the Creed, I believe in the forgiveness of sins. One prominent Reformation scholar, Bernd Hamm, who is now at Erlangen, has taken a very, very bitter attitude toward Ehlert and Althaus. And what he writes isn't really history. It's really some strange kind of scolding. He's not able to understand them. For instance, he takes a sermon that Althaus preached at Erlangen in the Neustädter Kirche on Christmas 1945. And, you know, the church was filled with refugees that had been driven out of their homes by the Russians. Their fathers and brothers and sons had been killed. There was no fuel in Erlangen. There was very little food. There was hardly any housing. And Althaus addressed these shivering people with the question, why have all these things happened? And he said, this is something that we cannot explain, but we leave it to God. Then he pointed them to the glad message of Christmas. Now, Hamm comes along later and says, this shows that Althaus was unrepentant for his sins, and that he never understood what had happened to Germany. Now, that is a dreadful distortion. And one can certainly do a better job than Bernd Hamm of explaining this. I remember Althaus in his ethics going into problems of the Third Reich one time in his class lecture. And he said, many an earnest Christian was faced with a terrible dilemma. He was asked to do something that he knew was wrong by the Nazis. And he had to decide whether he should resign his office or stay in office. If he resigned in his office, he'd probably be prosecuted and sent to the concentration camp. And if he resigned from office, someone, a terrible Nazi, would take his place. And that therefore, what many of these people did was to stay in office and try to prevent as much damage as possible. And this was the only thing they could do until the fall of Hitler. That was Althaus's comment on that.
Once again, would you join me in thanking Dr. Green? It was a pleasure to have you here.